Guys, a few quick announcements before the show. First, we are still doing a sale over at the Intensive Care Academy for the month of August, celebrating our one-year anniversary of being live. That's at ICU101.com, where there's like, I don't know, 40, 50 plus some video lessons on critical care topics, all sorts of things, some private podcast feeds, all kinds of educational stuff. But we have a promotion going until the end of August. You can get 20% off new subscriptions. Use the promo code AUG25, A-U-G-2-5, at checkout. Scope it out. It's not going to last forever. This is going up near the end of August, so you have only a handful of days. Number two, I will be speaking at the Vanderbilt Critical Care APP Boot Camp this year, which is September 3rd and 4th down in Nashville. If you are interested in hearing my sultry tones or any of the other smarter people in this great two-day intensive critical care course, come check it out. I think it's going to be awesome. All right, on to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the podcast. Brian Bowling with you, and as always, my partner in crime, Brandon Odo.
Hola.
Not actual crime. I feel like we should say that.
As far as they know. The statute of limitations runs out.
Right, yeah. I mean, this is being recorded, so as far as anyone knows, no actual crime. So we thought we'd talk about a drug that I have a lot of experience with. Brandon, I don't know if you use it a lot. I feel like a lot of people outside of the operating room environment probably don't, or probably haven't used it much and haven't heard of it, and that is a drug called Sugammadex. So we asked Sarah Hyland to join us, and Sarah is a clinical pharmacist at the Grant Medical Center up in Columbus, Ohio, where she practices mostly in the perioperative and ED areas and is just interested in lots of things, critical care and drugs. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian and Brandon. Big fan of the pod. Glad to be here.
All right, Sarah. Let me just tell you briefly about a patient. Let us say... maybe we're in a neuro ICU, let's say. And there's an adult male who turned up at the ED because he was found down at home. They bring him there. He's severely altered. They CT his head, and they find a bleed. He's got a substantial intraparenchymal hemorrhage involving the subarachnoid and intraventricular spaces. They think it's just a spontaneous thing. They do blood pressure management, bring him to the ICU, where the immediate topic of discussion is whether he needs to be intubated for his airway, and the consensus is, yeah, probably. So the ICU team is getting situated to intubate him, and there's a brief discussion about what agent to use to paralyze him for his RSI. And one of the considerations that gets raised is, well, this patient is kind of right in the crux of their neuro catastrophe. We need pretty good neuro checks. Maybe that's a reason to use a shorter acting paralytic so we can, you know, examine them sooner. Of course, there are pros and cons, but there's an anesthesia first year on the team who says, well, you know, you could just reverse it. Why don't we do that? And everyone says, oh, yeah, what about that? So reversal of neuromuscular blockade is a practice that is it's not new. I mean, it's been widely practiced and is very commonly done in certain settings, particularly the perioperative setting. It would almost be the norm in most cases if you were paralyzed for surgery to have it reversed at the end when they start thinking about extubating you. And in other settings, it's just about never, ever done, which makes it a kind of interesting one of those things where it's like, why is there such difference in practice? So let's backtrack a little, because I think for a fair number of the audience, in certain settings, they've probably had almost no experience with this. Just lay the groundwork here. What are the methods we could use to reverse these agents? And then we'll get into which we should use, or should we, or the considerations and whatever.
To answer your first question directly there, what are our options for reversing neuromuscular blockade? First of all, succinylcholine, it's going to reverse itself with the tincture of time.
Not reversible. Right? Don't need to.
Exactly. The aminosteroid class, your rock uranium, vecuroniums. We have the traditional option, theoretically, in some situations we'll get into, of neostigmine co-administered with glycopyrrolate or Sagaminex. And for our benzyl isoquinoliniums, or the atricurium cisat class, we only have that kind of traditional neostigmine glycopyrrolate combination option.
So just so typically when we're intubating people, we just kind of think of these, the two categories, sort of your depolarizing drugs like Sux and your, you know, longer acting non-depolarizers, which really is just rock uranium. I mean, sometimes we'll use other agents for longer term blockade, someone on the vent or something. But for, I mean, now I'm talking about the United States. I know that probably in other places they're still innovating with other drugs. But I mean, no one's using anything but rock, right? If they're gonna,
I would hope not in the RSI situation. In the RSI situation, you got Sux and rock, and yes, there's pros and cons to each. You know, that's subject for another pod, maybe. But yes, absolutely, in that immediate RSI situation, those are the two things we're thinking about.
And so there's, if we wanted to reverse rock, there's an older drug and there's a newer drug.
Mm-hmm. So neostigmine is an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. So what that means is it's not actually directly antagonizing the effect of the drug. What it's doing is breaking down or inhibiting the metabolism of your endogenous acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction. So what that means is it's just kind of giving your own acetylcholine a boost to try to overcome what that neuromuscular blocker is doing at the neuromuscular junction. And as you can kind of probably tell from that mechanism of action, there's going to be major limitations and complexities to what neostigmine can and cannot do. So first of all, in order to overcome that neuromuscular blockade with an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, giving your endogenous acetylcholine, you know, a boost, the amount of neuromuscular blocker at that junction has to have fallen to a pretty minimal level in order to, for your acetylcholine to overcome that and restore neuromuscular transmission. So first of all, neostigmine physically cannot reverse deep levels of neuromuscular blockade. There's just too much drug there, and all the acetylcholine in the world is not going to be able to overcome the amount of rock uranium at that receptor. It can incompletely and inconsistently, and with a lot of risk and side effects, somewhat antagonize shallower degrees of block in that kind of shallow to moderate range, which is a train of four of 1 to 3, basically. And it's not recommended to be used at those depths anymore because it, first of all, can be very ineffective. And then, but most concerningly, it can also become counter-effective, because if you have too much acetylcholine kind of going crazy in the neuromuscular junction, you can actually prolong and potentiate muscle weakness. And so I kind of think the analogy is somewhat similar to the way that protamine works. You know, if you give protamine in the absence of heparin or with insufficient heparin, protamine actually starts exerting an endogenous anticoagulant effect. And that could be very problematic when you think about the patients that we need to give protamine to, right? So neostigmine, in order to use it safely and properly, you can only really use it at minimal degrees of neuromuscular blockade. So when we have a train of four, that we have all four twitches back, and that's when that level of neuromuscular blockade is dropped to a sufficiently low amount that we can kind of use neostigmine reasonably effectively to overcome that blockade and help restore.
The analogy that comes to mind is when we give four-factor PCCs for, like, DOACs, you know, 10A inhibitors and things. You're not directly reversing that effect where you're stopping the inactivation. You're just trying to give whole heaps more, like, substrate for them to work with. So it's sort of, I mean, yeah, it sort of works, but it's sort of a sloppy mechanism. So, you know, you can't expect miracles here.
It's an indirect mechanism. Absolutely. That's a great analogy as well. And another thing that makes neostigmine, you know, complicated is the dosing needs to be very specific based on that degree of neuromuscular block that's present at the time you give it and the patient's weight. And the third thing that's really complicated is you have to co-administer it with glycopyrrolate because the neostigmine is going to potentiate the action of acetylcholine everywhere. So not just the neuromuscular junction where you're targeting it, but also in the myocardium at the muscarinic receptors. And that can cause profound bradycardia, bronchorrhea. And so we have to kind of counteract that side of the acetylcholinesterase inhibition with an anticholinergic glycopyrrolate. And so in order to give neostigmine, you have to give it at the right time, only to the right patient, in the right dose, and also in the right ratio with the anticholinergic to avoid those significant side effects. And so that's why you kind of see these, you know, comments and quips from a lot of seasoned anesthesiologists that, you know, residents these days, you know, they've lost, you know, the knowledge and the art of reversing neuromuscular blockade with neostigmine glycopyrrolate because they don't really have to learn it as much anymore. And it's very complicated.
Or DIG or something. I mean, my main experience was when I was a resident and I rotated through the CT surgery ICU. And we could get into some of these practices, but they would routinely reverse patients who came from the OR to facilitate extubation. And that's what they would do. The ICU team would come around and push neostigmine and glycopyrrolate. And like you said, it's a whole thing. I mean, you really must do train of fours, right? There's kind of no situation where you can avoid it.
That's correct. It's not like it's just, you know, a cheaper thing that you could do or that's reasonably like an alternative. It's strongly not recommended to use neostigmine at shallow, moderate, or deep degrees of block because it's not going to work. And yes, exactly, might make things worse.
Now, I mean, I guess I could imagine the pros of this approach. It's probably cheap, right? And we've done it a long time, so it's like forgetting how to do it, but it's a well-established practice.
So it's definitely has historical experience working for it. It did get rebranded because a company decided that, you know, oh, this is an old generic drug that never actually got like approved by the current, you know, mechanism. So we're going to do an RCT to just validate that neostigmine works and rebrand neostigmine. And that kicked off all the other generics off the market at the time. And so this rebranding was one thing that kind of really raised the cost of neostigmine. And then oftentimes we're also buying neostigmine and other anesthetic agents in kind of those cute pre-filled syringes that, you know, are really nifty. And those cost more, though, than those old generic vials, too. So the cost of neostigmine are pretty variable depending on which formulation you buy and the pricing at your institution. But, you know, ballpark neostigmine and glycopyrrolate, you know, per patient dose is probably going to be around $30 versus a 200 milligram vial of Sugammadex. It's going to be in the range of like $150 to $200. So, like, yes, Sugammadex costs more, but it's also like not vastly more, like hundreds of thousands of dollars more, first of all. And second of all, there's a lot of like indirect costs that you got to consider in this equation, right? Like if I came to you guys as critical care providers and was like, you know what, I got a cost savings initiative idea, you guys, we're not going to use Presidex and Propofol anymore in our analgo sedation regimens. We're going to put everybody on Versed drips because Versed is a lot cheaper and there's no reason not to do that because we'll save money, right? Like no one would ever think that, right? Like we know that the outcomes of, you know, our critical care patients are tremendously improved by using our shorter acting agents, lighter sedation, ICU liberation, blah, blah, blah. So it's like, we know things like ICU time is wildly expensive, right?
We're not going to pay for phones anymore. We're going to pay a man to blow a trumpet or something like
Right. So it's
cheaper.
There's all kinds of things we can get into with the cost side. I have some papers reference that I could refer your readers to on that topic too, but there's a lot more to consider than the direct drug cost. But yes, it costs more. That's
any other risks or contraindications to using this approach?
So for sticking with neostigmine, so you have both cholinergic and anticholinergic actions going on in there between your neostigmine and your glycopyrrolate, and even on neostigmine's best day, you know, we're using it only at those minimal levels of neuromuscular blockade. It's being used by a seasoned anesthesiologist who's getting the dosing and the ratio precisely correct. It's not going to work as fast or as consistent as our direct reversal option, Sugammadex, that we'll get into. And then we also have these risks of we could manifest both cholinergic and or anticholinergic toxicities in the patient. So when you think about, you know, maybe our frail elderly patients, or maybe our patients that have advanced AV nodal dysfunction, or, you know, people that are going to be very poorly served by either one of those, which is probably a lot of critical care patients, if not all of them. There are probably more risks there. But when we look at the perioperative literature and just honing in on when we're using neostigmine appropriately, so just comparing minimal blockade reversal between neostigmine and Sugammadex, overall side effects and efficacy are comparable in that kind of narrow slice of patients where it's appropriate to use and we dose and manage it appropriately.
Right. And probably worth emphasizing is, you know, in expert hands like that, if it is a nuanced thing, then that doesn't mean that, you know, Joe provider listening to this will have the same success. I mean, there's just so many levels here. It's like if I'm just all about analogies today. Like, if we didn't have metoprolol, we only had labetalol. So our approach when we didn't want to drop the heart rate was just to give labetalol plus atropine.
Right.
Does that work?
Right. It's like you're reversing a drug to reverse a drug to reverse a drug. Yeah. Like you kind of...
You're hoping it sums to the same thing. And it's not even like drips you can titrate to effect. You're just kind of pushing everything and you're just seeing where you land and you're like, hopefully...
Yeah, exactly.
So what's the new approach?
So the new approach, and right now, Sigambidex is the only option on the market. I want to make it clear that, you know, I'm not Sigambidex for everybody at all costs, and I'm definitely not getting any kickbacks or have any conflicts of interest with the Sigambidex company. There are other direct skeletal muscle antagonists coming to market soon, probably. So in the next 5 years, we're probably going to be having a broader conversation about not just Sigambidex. But right now, Sigambidex is our only alternative, and it's a tremendous step forward when this alternative came to market. It's been around in the EU since 2008. It was, the FDA approval was delayed in the United States until 2015. But it's basically the global standard right now for reversing neuromuscular blockade is a combination of quantitative neuromuscular monitoring plus reversal to a level that we know results in almost no residual neuromuscular blockade before we extubate patients after the anesthesia and surgical setting. And so Sigambidex is this, it's a gamma cyclodextrin molecule. So what that means is it's this giant sugar-based structure that's basically shaped like an ice cream cone, like a hollow conical structure. But it's like if you bit off the bottom of the ice cream cone to like try to slurp out the ice cream. So it's like this hollow cone with the end cut off of it. And so it has this lipophilic, you know, inner core that encapsulates rock uranium and vec uranium with overwhelming strength. So when it's administered, it will suck all of the rock uranium and vec uranium off of the neuromuscular junction and into this kind of ice cream cone structure. And the outside of this ice cream cone is hydrophilic. So that means that it just stays dissolved in the blood and gets filtered out through the kidneys at the glomerular filtration rate. And so it's a direct reversal agent that's physically removing the neuromuscular blocker from the neuromuscular junction. And it interacts with pretty much nothing else, almost no other drugs and no human receptors. So it's just this ice cream cone floating around, sucking up all of the rock uranium, vec uranium, and then keeping it encapsulated until it gets removed via the urine. And so doing this is also, you know, unlike neostigmine, it can do this, exert this action, irrespective of the degree of neuromuscular block present. So Sigambidex is our only option for reversing those deeper levels of neuromuscular blockade. When we look at just that minimal amount of neuromuscular blockade, when we have four twitches, you know, on trade of four that have come back to us, probably either option is reasonable in terms of efficacy and safety broadly. Although there are still patient-specific circumstances, and that might sway you one way or the other, but that might be like your cost savings option, basically, isn't that narrow slice of people. But Sigambidex is truly a direct reversal agent. It will exert its effects very quickly and very reliably. So a lot of people like to like make fun of anesthesiologists and how like excited and obsessed with Sigambidex they are. But once you see it, it's literally like you have this magic wand in your hand where this patient is, you know, apparently completely comatose, has no neuromuscular function, and you just push this drug and in less than a minute they are moving all four extremities. They're, you know, ready to be extubated within a few minutes. And that's just a huge step forward than what we were before Sigambidex was available to us, where we had to wait until neuromuscular blockade spontaneously recovered sufficiently that we could give neostigmine and then still wait 10 plus minutes after we give neostigmine to get them to a place that's safe for extubation and get them out the door. So it's not an exaggeration to say it has revolutionized anesthetic care and improved safety, because we know historically from the perioperative realm that residual neuromuscular blockade is incredibly common and incredibly dangerous to our patients. And what I mean by this is that if we, you know, intubate patients for surgery, we do the surgery, and then we extubate them and send them to the PACU without any neuromuscular blockade reversal, about 2/3 of patients will have residual neuromuscular blockade on board in that setting. So in the complete absence of reversal. And even if we narrow that down to patients who had at least 2 hours elapsed between the time they got their ocuronium and the time they hit the PACU, still over a third of those patients will have residual neuromuscular blockade present. And we've realized that neuromuscular blockade significantly predisposes our patients to postoperative complications, unplanned ICU admissions, reintubations, also just prolonged muscle weakness and prolonged lengths of stay, delayed recovery, and patients hate it. They feel terrible with residual neuromuscular blockade on board, even if nothing super terrible happens to them. And so now in surgery, it's unheard of to do that. We would never do that anymore. We literally have a global standard now based on piles of high quality data and every international guideline on this topic, saying that, you know, we must assess neuromuscular blockade, and this should be done with an objective monitor, which we can get into what that means, versus just a peripheral nerve stimulator. But we really need to hone in on not just what that train of four count is, but a train of four ratio of at least 90%. That's the global standard for what it means to not have residual neuromuscular blockade on board, and it's safe to extubate. So when we take this back to your patient, the data for ICU is way more sparse. Like, we're just nowhere there. We're probably where we were with periop like 20 years ago. But there was this prospective study out of New Zealand a couple years ago where they went around with objective neuromuscular blockade monitors in an ICU and about 200 patients. And these were patients that you had lightened the sedation on, you were planning on extubating them. And we measured their degree of residual neuromuscular blockade, and over 40% of them had a degree of blockade that is considered unsafe to extubate them in the perioperative setting. And yet here we are in the ICU with these patients that are infinitely sicker and more complicated than our average, you know, surgical patient. And we're extubating them all the time without assessing neuromuscular blockade and reversing in a meaningful way. So it's very interesting how disparate these two degrees of awareness and, you know, the clinical standards are right now. But if I was that patient that you're extubating, I would be really hoping that somebody would measure my degree of neuromuscular blockade and reverse it before extubating me. Although I don't have the data and the guidance in the ICU setting to say that with a strong recommendation that we should be doing this routinely. We're just not there yet.
Yeah, let's circle back to that, because that's an interesting question, especially people in like SICUs where we get a lot of post-ops, in some cases may still be intubated. But just on the practical level, so is there any need or role to measure a train of four or by other means before you use Sugammadex, or it just doesn't matter? It doesn't affect the dose, it doesn't affect the efficacy?
So this is a very important question, and this has been kind of postulated and debated, but ultimately the data is pretty clear that Sugammadex alone is not a silver bullet, and just using it in the absence of objective neuromuscular blockade is not going to guarantee that you avoid dangerous degrees of residual neuromuscular blockade, or that you avoid kind of that recurarization risk, meaning you reverse them, but then they become blocked again. So the standard that, you know, that we should all be, you know, getting to as soon as we can, upheld in all of the guidelines in the anesthesia space, is that we need to use a objective monitor to assess neuromuscular blockade first, and then reverse to that train to four ratio of at least 90% prior to extubation. And that using Sugammadex does not obviate the need for that objective neuromuscular blockade. Even if you're kind of shooting blind and giving Sugammadex all the time, probably up to like 10% of patients can still have residual neuromuscular blockade in the absence of monitoring.
So let's define our terms a little, because I think for the typical ICU nurse, especially, the only monitoring they're doing is a train of four, and they stick it on somebody's face or arm or whatever and count twitches. You're talking about something more quantified than that.
Yeah. So there's, I linked some good reviews on this if you just want like a quick primer on neuromuscular blockade monitoring. But what you're talking about is a basic peripheral nerve stimulator, that kind of little bug zapper thing that we can, you know, just kind of give them four twitches and then visually count the twitches. And that gives us a train of four count. So four out of four twitches is, you know, the most recovery or the least amount of neuromuscular blockade. And it, you know, goes down like that. The issue with a peripheral nerve stimulator and the train of four count is that it's woefully insensitive for detecting what is still clinically relevant levels of residual neuromuscular blockade. So you could have a train of four count of four twitches and still have 70% of your nicotinic acetylcholine receptors occupied by rocuronium. 70% of them.
We need 10 twitches then.
Exactly. So we're fortunate evolutionarily. We have tremendous redundancy in our neuromuscular junction for like good reasons. But there's a lot of rock uranium that could still be on board with 4 out of 4 twitches. So you need a more sophisticated device. And so what you're working with right now, your little bug zapper things, that's called a qualitative train of 4. And that's how you get a train of 4 count. The standard that is going to be sensitive enough is called a objective assessment. And these devices are going to be a more sophisticated peripheral nerve stimulator that's going to use... There's a number of different technologies out there. There's like accelerometers, there's electromyometers, so like AMG or EMG, or there's even KNG. These are all just like different technologies that will assess not only the train of 4 count, but the train of 4 ratio. And the train of 4 ratio is the ratio of that height of that fourth twitch compared to that first twitch. So you may have heard the concept of fade when we talk about the train of 4. So is that twitch like strong, 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 strong all the way from 1 to 4? Or is it kind of like strong, strong, not as strong, a little weak? You know, like there's still 4 twitches there, but we have fade present because that strength of that fourth one is not as high as the strength of that first one. And that is evidence of neuromuscular blockade persisting. And so the train of 4...
Whereas with a qualitative test, all you'd know is that there was a twitch.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you could try to eyeball. That looked pretty strong, but that's...
Yeah, you could say, oh, there was fade or there wasn't fade. And you could pair that with your, you know, your clinical assessments, like your, you know, your 5-second head lift or your grip strength or, you know, certain tidal volumes. But the research is pretty clear that those kind of qualitative assessments or that qualitative train of 4 are very insensitive to picking up on clinically relevant residual neuromuscular blockade. And so what you really need is one of these more sophisticated devices and to assess a train of 4 ratio. And you want that ratio of that fourth twitch height to that first twitch height to be at least 0.9. So that fourth twitch height is 90% or more of that first twitch height. That's the threshold by which we say it's safe to extubate the patient. And all of this obviously is in the context of extubating the patient that I'm talking about right now. If you're not extubating the patient and, you know, you're just, that patient's going to be intubated and you just need like serial neuro assessments, that's kind of a different conversation and a different approach. But in terms of just orienting everybody to what the peripheral nerve stimulator, you know, device options are and what this terminology means and what the literature says regarding safety of extubation, it's a train of 4 ratio as assessed by an objective neuromuscular monitor of at least 90%.
And so when you talk about using it paired with Sugammadex, you're saying we should give them Sugammadex, assess them, and then make sure we got the an adequate effect because we might need to give more? That's basically the...
Almost. So at the end of a case, the anesthesiologist should first assess the train of 4 ratio, or if we're not even recovered to 4 twitches yet, you can't even calculate a train of 4 ratio. You're too deeply blocked at that point. You got to start with that train of 4 count. And if you're too deeply blocked that you don't even have a single twitch on train of 4 count, then you have to do what's called a post-tetanic count. And that's how you can assess even deeper degrees of block. But basically, you need to assess neuromuscular blockade first. And depending on that depth of neuromuscular block, oftentimes it's still going to be moderately deep at that point because you're probably, you know, less than 2 hours from your rock uranium. You're going to need to then, you know, assess it, know where you're starting, give a reversal agent that is tailored to that degree of neuromuscular blockade, and then reassess it and make sure that you get to that train of 4 ratio of at least 90% before you pull the tube. So if you are at the end of the case, your train of 4 count is 2, you are moderately blocked and your only option is Sugammadex there. You're probably going to give something like 4 milligrams per kilo of Sugammadex. You're going to let that work for a couple minutes and then you're going to reassess. And hopefully at that point you have like very good recovery and you can calculate a train of 4 ratio. And when that ratio gets to 0.9 or greater, then you can pull the tube, ship the patient to PACU.
Okay. So Sugammadex will work at most degrees of block, but it does change the dose, how deep they are.
Precisely. So you have to measure the block to know which agent is even an option and also what the appropriate dose of the agent is. And then you're going to confirm that before you extubate.
And then you're saying you can also have recurrence of blockade. So essentially, Sugammadex doesn't last as long as rock uranium can?
Well, this is a really interesting kind of subtopic, but like the recurarization risk with Sigamidex is it's rare and it's not completely understood. But one thing that can happen is if you, you know, if you just grossly underdose your Sigamidex relative to the degree of block, they might get, you know, an immediate response, but it's just not going to be sufficient to outlast the effect of all the rock uranium that's still floating around. And they could still kind of slide back into some more block.
So it should last longer than the rock if you give enough. But if you underdose, then you might get a temporary effect only.
That's one risk point. The other risk point that's been found is that even at appropriate doses of Sigamidex, if we don't confirm that, there's still patient variability even with Sigamidex. It's a lot less than neostigmine, but you can give the appropriate dose. But if you don't confirm that you're at a train of four ratio of 0.9, you still might need to giving more Sigamidex to some patients. So in studies that have really honed in on this using quantitative monitoring and dose finding, most patients are going to be fine with that manufacturer labeled, but there's still like probably 20% of patients that are going to need more, even though you gave the right dose. So there's going to be patient variability, even if the right dose is given, that you're going to need to confirm with objective monitoring to ensure you have a safe and successful extubation.
I mean, you're talking about recurarization. Is that common enough that somebody who was reversed, extubated, and then maybe they're having respiratory distress half an hour later, it would be worth reassessing their train of four just to see if they could be weak again?
Yeah. And this actually happened to me once. It was relatively early on in our experience with Sigamidex, but I remember distinctly, like, this patient came out of the OR that he was in the PACU. He had been reversed with a completely appropriate dose of Sigamidex, but because he was probably a bigger guy and he probably got pretty hypercapnic and kind of slid into like a more respiratory acidotic state, there's also a concern that even with enough Sigamidex, a acid-based disturbance could potentially kind of change its dissociation curve. And it could kind of let go of some of that rock uranium. And so this guy who was like recovering adequately had gotten a completely adequate, you know, amount of Sigamidex, although we do not have quantitative neuromuscular monitoring. So he may not have been fully recovered. We don't know. But he was in the PACU recovering, and all of a sudden he just like went completely flaccid and was not breathing and was not responsive. And so the anesthesiologist was emergently called, and he was like, and it was kind of one of our lower anesthesiologists, he's like, give me some more neostigmine. And I was like, doc, I think we need to give him more Sigamidex. And we pushed more Sigamidex, and he immediately reanimated. Like, he was not arresting. He wasn't out of it. He just recurarized. Like, he just literally had an abrupt re-onset of paralysis. And so that is absolutely something you should think about. If you have somebody, even if they were adequately reversed, most places are not completely outfitted with quantitative neuromuscular monitoring at this point. Even like, you know, probably most of our big academic centers with big surgery centers, because these devices, they're so expensive, they're new, it's a capital expenditure to outfit all your ORs with them. We're just, even though we know this is the standard and the guidelines, we're really far away from this being in daily practice across the country. So, you know, if somebody all of a sudden is presenting like that, or even if it's more gradual and you're just like, you know what, they were reversed, but they could be recurarizing, that's absolutely something to consider. And, you know, if you have time to assess the neuromuscular blockade and get some objective data there, cool. But honestly, like, we ran in there and gave this particular patient Sigamidex so that he didn't completely have a respiratory arrest in the PACU, because that's something that we knew we could do very quickly, and that immediately reversed him again. And so there's still risks for residual neuromuscular blockade and recurarization with Sigamidex if you're not using objective monitoring, especially.
Okay, just to round out basic stuff here, any other risks or complications with Sigamidex? I mean, I assume you could be allergic as you can to anything, but what else?
Yeah, so the allergic reaction risk to Sigamidex has been like a huge topic. That's actually what delayed its FDA approval in the United States. The company submitted to the FDA in 2008, just when they did, you know, with Europe. And the advisory panel to the FDA unanimously said, we need to approve Sigamidex. Like, this is a huge, you know, thing that we need to advance patient care. But the FDA said, no, we want more data about the allergic reaction risk, and demanded all of these additional studies and data, and delayed approval for more data specific to that risk until 2015. So the interesting thing about the anaphylaxis risk with Sugammadex, so first of all, it is incredibly rare, as anaphylaxis to everything is. And it also seems like it's less likely even than anaphylaxis to neuromuscular blockers. Definitely less than antibiotics in the perioperative setting based on the large observational data sets that we have now. The risk is probably way less than 1%, probably more like the 0.01%. There's quite a range there that you'll find, obviously. You know, identifying true anaphylaxis to a specific agent is obviously very difficult. But the reason why it's such a concern is because cyclodextrin molecules are actually like ubiquitous in our environment. Like, they're additives in a bunch of like cosmetics, in additives in food. So like there are compounds that we are constantly exposed to in like the cyclodextrin class all the time. So even though like you've never been exposed to Sugammadex specifically, theoretically, like if it's in your shampoo or your makeup or your Fritos or something, you could potentially be sensitized to it and be at an increased risk of having an anaphylactic reaction when you get Sugammadex. So it's not non-existent, but the data that we have suggests that it is very rare. And what else is interesting is that anaphylaxis to rock uronium can actually probably be treated with Sugammadex. So rock uronium is actually, you know, one of the more allergenic drugs that anesthesiologists give. And anaphylaxis to rock uronium has actually been successfully treated with Sugammadex, because you'll just encapsulate that and remove the allergen immediately. And
it's like chelating it.
Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting tidbit. But in addition to the anaphylaxis risk, which does appear low, you do have risks of bradycardia and hypotension. And very rarely, there's a number of case reports series on this, though. We don't know why, but every once in a very long while, like somebody just like has an all-out cardiovascular collapse after being reversed with Sugammadex, and it can be very difficult to treat. And it's not super clear why this has happened. And obviously at the end of a case, you know, the patient has gotten a lot of different medications and interventions at that point. It's kind of hard to pin it all, but I would say that overall Sugammadex is a drug that is given probably hundreds of thousands of times a day around the world. Like, it's incredibly well tolerated. It doesn't interact with human receptors or like almost anything else in the body. And side effects are generally very low, but the biggest things to probably worry about, you know, in a critical care population especially, is monitoring for bradycardia and also hypotension. Generally mild and transient type things, but could be a big deal in the wrong patient.
All right, so then there's more things to talk about, but we got to start with the elephant in the room. Why is this not more widely used in the ICU? I mean, I'll tell you, like I said, the only time I've seen it is specifically in the post-op cardiac surgery population, but I've been in a variety of other settings, and it is not, it's not even available, I'm pretty sure, in the unit. And even though you could imagine emergent situations like failed airways where it could be relevant. So I don't know how this situation arose, because it sounds like it's like in the water down in the OR.
Yeah, it absolutely is. This is a really interesting question. This is something that I ponder all the time. This is something that I'm actively doing collaborative research on to try to, you know, put up the data and bridge this gap. So my best explanation to answer that question is I just don't think people realize how much residual neuromuscular blockade is apparent in our ICU patients. I think ICU providers are just barely starting to wake up to this concept, no pun intended, that, you know, there's probably a lot of residual paralysis going on, and that probably is contributing to a lot of badness. And that's where we were 15, 20 years ago in anesthesia. And now, you know, like, you know, when we think about 20 years ago, if you got surgery under general anesthesia, when we woke you up to extubate you, you know, the anesthesiologist would be like, Brandon, lift your head up, hold it up. Okay, good. Give me a hand squeeze. Okay. You know, and when you could lift your head for 5 seconds and squeeze someone's hand and pull adequate tidal volumes, they were like, okay, the neuromuscular blockade is gone. I can extubate you safely. And now we know that that's just not safe. Like, you know, like I said, 2/3 of patients under those circumstances will still have residual neuromuscular blockade and a lot of adverse outcomes. You know, here we are now where we know that not only is it not okay to subjectively assess your neuromuscular blockade, we got to use objective monitoring and we have to use targeted reversal and that combination to keep people safe. Yet here we are in the ICU. We have, you know, 40% or more of these like way more sick and complicated patients that we're just like, okay, we give them their spontaneous awakening and breathing trials. They're passing it. We're going to pull the tube today. And it's, we think it's all going to go fine. But, you know, why do we think that? Why do we have such, you know, confidence in that based on what we've learned in the perioperative setting? So I think that, you know, there's just this huge awareness and knowledge gap that's just starting to be quantified. And I'm hoping it doesn't take another 10, 20 years to get the research to catch up to kind of quantifying these and elucidating what we should be doing about this in the ICU. I also think another thing that's getting a lot of attention in the ICU population that I'm hoping will drive some of this research is we now are realizing that, you know, maybe 10% or more of ICU survivors have crippling PTSD from awareness under paralysis. And I don't know if you guys follow, SAEM had a tremendous webinar on this recently where a critical care nurse herself became an ICU patient after I think she had like a massive STEMI. And she came in with, you know, this ACS and cardiogenic shock. She ends up getting intubated with etomidate and ROCK and not adequately sedated. And she is aware of everything going on with her care, even though she is paralyzed and unable to move or react. She can hear the doctors talking about it. She's freaking out about like, oh my God, are they going to take me to open heart surgery and do surgery on me with me still being awake in here? And it's just a harrowing story. And it's just really alarming because we're probably doing this to patients way more often than we think or that is acceptable, and we just don't realize it. And that's what keeps me up at night right now. I don't know how you feel, but that sounds like something that is probably akin to like human torture that we're just like accidentally doing to our patients all the time. And so I think
now, I mean, the majority, not all, but the majority of our intubated patients were intubated a while ago. So I think a lot of people would say, well, listen, I mean, this guy had his ROCK ages ago. And I mean, how you choose to quantify that, many people will just say it's been a long time. But you could say, you know, it's been four or five half-lives of the drug or something like that. Is that not, I mean, if someone was intubated yesterday, is it not a safe bet that they've cleared their drug by now?
Yeah, this is a super fair question. So going back to that study from New Zealand, you know, that unfortunately directly debunks that assumption. You know, going around and testing objectively neuromuscular blockade in all of these ICU patients that were intubated a while ago that we're now extubating, over 40% of them still had residual neuromuscular blockade. And I think that, you know, to dive into that a bit, I think that, you know, if you asked a bunch of ICU providers, you know, what's the duration of action of ROCK uronium? You know, they'll say, you know, 30 to 60 minutes or, you know, about 40 minutes or, you know, something in that range. And they wouldn't be wrong. That's what the package insert says. But one thing we need to understand is that the definition of the duration of action of a neuromuscular blocker is the median time to 25% of that first twitch height. So the median time to 25% of that first twitch reemerging on train of four. And so what that means is that, you know, after 40, 60 minutes, whatever you want to call it, 25% of your patients will have at least a quarter of their first twitch back. And half of them haven't even gotten to that point yet. And that's what the duration of action is defined as. That's where those numbers come from. That's the definition used in the clinical trials for neuromuscular blockers. So 40 to 60 minutes is by no means the duration of clinically relevant neuromuscular blockade from ROCK uronium or VAC uronium. It's the median time to 25% T1 twitch height. And so there's also, beyond the fact that these drugs last way longer than anyone understands, the patient variability in response is incredibly wide. If you look at the trials that brought ROCK uronium to market, the 0.6 milligram per kilo dose that anesthesia uses in general anesthesia, so not even the RSI dose, you know, that we use or should be using, that 0.6 milligram per kilo ROCK uronium dose has like a median duration of action using that definition of about 32 minutes, but the range was anywhere from like 20 minutes to 90 minutes. Like, it is a huge range. So there's basically the key pearl here. That's a really long way of saying all this, but the key pearl here is there's no amount of time that guarantees in a particular patient that ROCK uronium or VAC uronium has worn off. There's no amount of time that we can say with certainty, just looking at them or counting the minutes, that it's gone without
especially
assessing neuromuscular blockade.
Vulnerable and yeah. A 10% difference might be the difference between them failing or breathing.
Yeah, and those studies are in, you know, healthier, younger people getting general anesthesia for elective surgery. they're not in critically ill patients whose, you know, metabolic derangements and comorbidities and, you know, pathophysiology at play are also traumatically prolonging even, you know, those very long durations of actions and really variable durations of action. So I think I would just, you know, offer that that's an assumption that seems reasonable based on what we know historically. But I think we need to look at what we've learned from periop and look at the data that's emerging in ICU and start challenging that and start questioning, you know, is this patient really safe to extubate even though their acronym was, you know, yesterday or days ago? And how do I know that? And maybe we should start checking it and, you know, studying this more.
Yeah. Well, so that's, I mean, you're really pairing the idea of SOGAMIDEX with the use of these more quantified devices for assessing the muscle function. I'm going to tell you, I've never seen one of these. And if I went to the leadership now and said, hey, this is like what we should be doing, I am sure someone's going to say, well, they're real expensive compared to our bug zapper.
Totally.
So, I mean, is this a surmountable barrier? I mean, it's not like you need one on every bedside, I suppose, but if it's not practical to do all the testing, then do you still end up ahead if we just empirically were giving SOGAMIDEX to some of these people?
So basically, I think, you know, this is an important question. First of all, like, what can we do right now? Like, we don't have all these devices. We're not going to get these devices anytime soon if we ever get them in all of our, you know, ICUs. Although I do think, you know, if you buy one for your ICU, that would be a huge win for patient safety. I do advocate for that for sure, if you could talk anybody into it. But in the meantime, you know, if all you have is a bug zapper at the bedside, use it and see, do they have four strong twitches at the time that we are extubating? And even if they do, you know, really make sure you're doing a complete clinical assessment of neuromuscular function, probably paired with that qualitative assessment, before you confirm that they're extubated or extubatable. And I think, you know, even just doing a train of four count on all of your patients is probably a good first step, because if you don't have four good twitches, or if you have, you know, four maybe not so great twitches, I think it's probably perfectly reasonable to apply what like an anesthesiologist would be doing in that setting and give them an appropriate dose of SOGAMIDEX before you extubate them. And for the record, that's what most anesthesiologists in the country are doing right now, because they don't all have quantitative monitors. Like I said, that's the standard, that's the guidelines, that's what the evidence tells us we need to be doing. But like, most anesthesiologists are not even operating under those optimal conditions right now. They're looking at a qualitative train of four count and giving SOGAMIDEX according to, you know, the depth of neuromuscular blockade and that patient's weight.
And the only harm in erring on the side of giving it is the cost and, you know, small risks, I suppose.
I think so. I think if the patient is doing well enough that you're extubating them, they're probably not wildly hemodynamically unstable that I'm worried that, you know, our heart rate or blood pressure changes are going to be, you know, clinically significant or majorly detrimental. That's definitely, you know, $150, $200 each time you do that. But, you know, what's the cost of, you know, a reintubation? What's the cost of, you know, a pneumonia, an aspiration event? All these things that we know happen with greater frequency if we let residual neuromuscular blockade persist after extubation, because even though they can maybe lift their head up or they're breathing because their big diaphragmatic muscle that gets a lot of blood flow and reverses faster after, you know, the neuromuscular blocker is wearing off, we know that all those little small muscles of the upper airway that actually protect our airway are the slowest ones to recover from neuromuscular blockade. And that's where we're leaving our patients really vulnerable.
And it sounds like if there's a time to think about this, the post-op patient in the ICU, which is not the most common situation, perhaps. And we talked about CT surgery, but there are other situations too. Someone just wasn't quite awake yet in the PACU, things like that. Those would probably be the most likely situation to benefit, because you know they're paralyzed probably relatively recently, maybe compared to a lot of our other patients. And you really want to extubate them, and you're sort of acting in the perioperative anesthesia role there. And if they should be doing this, then we should do it. Now, again, if you don't have devices, then you're kind of forced to guess a little bit. I mean, perhaps you can communicate with the OR and maybe anesthesia can come help out if they're better at this, but still kind of along those lines versus just saying, well, they're awake, they're squeezing my hand, they're breathing, I'm sure they're fine. Maybe they have four twitches if we even measured.
Yeah, you nailed it. I think that, you know, that's the low-hanging fruit right there, are those patients that were recently they got surgery, now they're in the ICU, you want to extubate them, we should probably be doing something similar to what anesthesia is doing. We're probably within the purview of, like, I guess, what the anesthesia guidelines would be applicable to. And I think that would be a great place to start, is, you know, those patients that, okay, they had surgery today or yesterday, we're extubating them. Let's check a train of four. Let's give a little bit of Sigammadex, whatever amount of Sigammadex we think is appropriate for that degree of block as far as we can assess it. Or absolutely better yet, let's call anesthesia. Just, are we on the same page? Maybe we should work out an institutional protocol here that's like, you know, okay, anesthesia and ICU, and everyone can kind of come together and figure out, like, okay, under these circumstances, we're going to do XYZ. This is how we're going to assess it, when we might reverse. I think those are all really good things that we should probably start making a move on.
Now, what about a case like we introduced with more of the, they're going to stay on the vent, but we'd like to do things like neuro exams. It would seem like you might be able to pull the same move here, but it's not as demanding because they don't have to be completely back to their normal strength. We just like them to be awake and able to move in basically a qualitative fashion. Like, they could be weak, for instance, as long as they're equally weak, and we could appreciate those differences. Would a reasonable move here be to give a low dose of Sigammadex and kind of titrate to effect where we're able to get that exam?
100%. And this is something that I and multiple others at this point, in the references I gave you, we basically have a small mountain of retrospective studies doing this very thing and exploring this. And I have in table three of the publication that I led previously that kind of just gives you like a checklist to work when you're in this specific situation and thinking about, you know, should I do this? How should I do this? But I think the short answer is, you know, when you're not extubating somebody, you just really don't want them to be paralyzed anymore. And a timely neuroassessment is a very good reason to do that. Especially initially when it's like neurosurgery needs to know, like, I need to prognosticate this patient. I need to decide, am I doing an emergent cranial right now or not? Like, that is a huge moment to make this assessment and utilize this therapy because, you know, as you said, they're not being extubated. I don't need to give them a ton of Sigammadex or ensure that they have a train of four ratio of 90% or more. That's not the goal right now. The goal right now is to make sure they're not very paralyzed. The goal right now is to get a meaningful neuro assessment.
If they're not moving, it's not because they can't.
Exactly. You want certainty that it's like, okay, do they have a salvageable brain in there or not? And, you know, and you want to be able to serially, you know, assess that obviously after, you know, surgical intervention, especially, and things like that. So under those circumstances, you know, again, if you have even a bug zapper, grab your peripheral nerve stimulator and make an assessment, because that I think is still helpful. But give a low amount of Sigammadex in that instance. Just give 200 milligrams of Sigammadex. You don't have to dose it probably even based on their weight or, you know, even based too literally on like their depth of neuromuscular blockade. I think having that data, if you can access it, is probably helpful, but, you know, just give them a little bit because we don't need to extubate them. We just need to make sure they're not very paralyzed. And you can do that very quickly and very effectively with small amounts of Sigammadex. Absolutely. And just to elaborate on that based on, you know, just our findings from, you know, my personal study, this was just a case series of a dozen ICU and ER patients that we had kind of done this exact situation on. These patients were anywhere from 42 to like 200 something minutes after their rocuronium. And we gave them small doses of Sigammadex and they would immediately go from a GCS of 3T to a GCS of like 10T for the patients that were, you know, in there. And even the patients that, you know, didn't change, the neurosurgeons were like, I'm so thankful that I have certainty in my exam and in my prognostication that I can go to the family and I can tell them with certainty, like, okay, we've made a thoughtful assessment. We've removed all the confounders from the situation, and this is what you're looking at in terms of prognosis. But there's lots of patients in this situation that will appear completely comatose, and a fair amount of them are not actually comatose. We just don't realize it because we haven't reversed.
Well, and you can imagine that coming up in other cases, like maybe the patient who was on a prolonged paralytic drip for ARDS or something, and maybe you stopped it a day or two ago and now they're really out of it. You know, maybe some of those people are still paralyzed. And what do you do? I mean, maybe one thing, if you could just maybe as simple as maybe a train of four and just, oh man, they only have two twitches. They stopped yesterday. Maybe they need to be back on more sedation or something. I mean, maybe as simple as feeding things like delirium, because now you have an awake paralyzed patient. That would be, I would imagine, a even more likely a situation when you have, you know, longer accumulation of drugs and things like that.
Absolutely. There's actually a few published case reports like this that, you know, a patient was on a continuous rocuronium drip for ARDS and it was stopped days ago and the patient wasn't waking up and someone was just like, let's give them some Sugammadex. And all of a sudden they like jump off the bed and try to self-extubate. And it's like,
they want to pull the tube out to call you an asshole. Yeah,
exactly. Like they've been in there that whole time. And it's like, how often are we doing this to people? You know, for sure, just psychologically, but then also, you know, all these people that we extubate, yeah, how many complications that they have downstream could be related to this.
Well, the other situation that I kind of in categories of Sugammadex would be the failed airway. So the, you know, you RSI someone, you can't intubate them. You say, well, let's try to reverse them and let them breathe as a solution here. We had Nick Crimes on the show a little while ago talking about how you probably not expect Sugammadex to like rescue you if the patient is like hypoxic and about to code here. But, you know, maybe there's situations where that's a move. In that circumstance, is it basically, I mean, can we just give them a really big dose? I mean, do we need to do all this monitoring?
No. Okay. So yeah, absolutely. And as per that prior discussion, you know, no one should probably be in a can't intubate, can't ventilate situation expecting Sugammadex to save you there. There's probably like a one in a million thing where yeah, it could. And, you know, I've read a case report to that effect. Obviously, generally speaking, you know, if don't let Sugammadex get in the way of you, like, you know, getting a surgical airway or whatever needs to happen there. But, you know, there are those select circumstances where it's like, okay, you know, they can breathe on their own. That wasn't the reason why we needed to intubate them. Let me back out, take away this neuromuscular blockade, get them breathing again. Because in a certain situation, you know, you can't support them in that, you know, Sugammadex is not going to obviously reverse the reason they need to be intubated, I guess is the bottom line. But, you know, in that instance, you can give a large dose of Sugammadex and reverse the rocuronium very reliably. You don't need to delay for monitoring in that situation, I wouldn't say. It just kind of comes down to, you know, thinking carefully about if that's the right move or not, because, you know, if they still need intubated, honestly, continuing the paralysis is usually in the best interest because they're going to bag easier while you, you know, call anesthesia or prepare for a surgical airway, whatever you need to do.
Can you reparalyze them if you gave Sugammadex?
Yeah. So the next complication though, that I was going to raise with that decision-making, and, you know, we kind of have all of this in our table three from our publication too, if you want just a concise summary of this, is, you know, that using Sugammadex changes your downstream options and approach for sure. So if you still need to RSI them, Sugammadex is probably not a good idea because it's not a light switch. You can't, once you've given it, that Sugammadex is going to be on board for like hours to days.
Days. Okay.
you can't, exactly. It clears at the rate of the glomerular filtration, right? So, you know.
Oh, it's renally cleared. Okay.
A healthy person's going to. Yes, Sugammadex is, exactly. And the complex that it forms.
So like a dialysis patient might have it for like until they get dialyzed again.
Yeah, we should talk about that. There's some wild stuff to consider with the renal patients. But yeah, and you know, in the situation, you know, a potential, you know, using Sugammadex in an airway emergency reversal type situation, you know, you're not going to be able to immediately give
you
rock
give sucks.
Again. You'll be able to give rock again in higher doses later, and kind of overcome that, or you're going to have to switch gears and you're going to have to give sucks, or you could even intubate theoretically with like atricurium if you give a proper dose. It's not ideal, but like you can do it if you need to. So yeah, you want to think about that, especially if the patient, like, you know, in our neurosurgery patients, this kind of comes up and it's like, okay, we reverse for an exam, but then we're going for an emergent cranny. It's like, okay, well, we can do that, but that changes an anesthesiologist's strategy big time. And so that continuity and those downstream decision, you know, implications, yeah, definitely need to
tell
be.
Anesthesia if you case again.
Exactly. Like, by the way, we did this.
It's like when I tell IR that I used both their FEMs for lines.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. They're going to be like, wait, what? But yeah, the renal patients are an interesting subset. You know, basically the rocuronium by itself is like barely renally eliminated. It's mainly biliary eliminated, and usually that's not like a concern. But once it's in Sugammadex, that complex is like 100% renally eliminated. And so the, you know, end stage renal patient is going to have that complex floating around for days, maybe even like 2 weeks by some reports. it will be removed by like a high flux dialysis situation. It may not actually be all that well removed by like CRRT, depending on your rate, though. So there's a lot to think about there because, you know, they still have a paralytic floating around in their body. It's just like in the
can it unbind? Like,
and if something disassociates there, then all of a sudden they're paralyzed again and they might not have a protected airway at that point. And so for that reason, the manufacturer has said this drug shouldn't be used in patients with significant renal impairment or dialysis.
That's all everyone in the ICU. You're ruining this for me.
Exactly. Since then, though, there have been plenty of studies that have provided, I think, a lot of reassurances that we can use this drug very pretty safely, and that, moreover, the alternatives in that population are very unsafe, too. Because they're probably going to have residual neuromuscular blockade for a lot longer.
Are there reports of people like a day and a half later who like re-paralyze because all their little like complexes dissociated?
Not that I've seen. That's definitely the theoretical concern. You know, there's definitely, obviously, like someone with advanced renal failure has like a lot of reasons to crump at a lot of different, you know, times. And so it's kind of hard to say definitively that that's never happened. But that's definitely the theoretical risk that gets everybody like, you know, uncomfortable historically. But like I said, we have a lot of data in the renally impaired now, and that situation does not seem very likely.
More theoretical than.
Yeah. You know, and it's always risk benefits, right? So like, what's the risk of not doing this? Cause that's often very substantial, you know, in that same population too.
Final thing, is it very expensive? It's 2025 for all you listeners in other worlds.
So, I mean, like I said, you know, you're probably looking at $150-$200 every time you do this, you know, with Sigavidex. But I think that you really got to zoom out and look at, you know, the patient outcomes and, you know, all of the costs of care implications and not just the drug acquisition cost. In the grand scheme of an ICU stay, you know, $200 is not going to be very significant.
Maybe don't give it to every person we extubate for no reason, but you know, using it sporadically is nothing.
Exactly. The reason that, you know, the cost concern, when the cost concerns become really big is when you're, you know, an executive and you're at a huge hospital-based surgery center that's doing, you know, 20,000-100,000 surgeries a year, and all of a sudden anesthesia started using 100% Sigamidex instead of 100% eustibia. Like, that is going to like be a huge cost difference in drug acquisition costs. But I mean, PACU time and complications are very expensive. And so, you know, cost benefit is definitely there, probably regardless of where you're using it. In the ICU, like, you're never going to be anywhere on the same scale as anesthesia's use. So I honestly think you would probably be able to fly under the radar from a pure cost perspective if you can work with your, you know, pharmacy departments and your, you know, interprofessional teams on, you know, institutional protocols and just making it like available and like defining reasonable use and like, you know, when we're gonna do this, why we're gonna do this, how are we going to do this. But you're not going to be doing it like on every single person senselessly. And so, you know, I don't think that the cost should be a barrier to, you know, assessing this and studying this further. I think based on, you know, what we know with the perioperative realm, there's a lot of cost savings to be had by avoiding residual neuromuscular blockade.
Brian, what else?
I don't know. I think we've pretty much covered everything. You know, I used to work in CT surgery, and so we reverse people regularly. And now I reverse people pretty regularly in the neuro ICU. Most of the people come in from IR, you know, being admitted after a stroke and thrombectomy and stuff, just to sort of facilitate that exam, but also early extubation. But it's interesting to hear about the potential prolonged effects, because all this time I kept thinking, yeah, but what about all the people, all my friends work in the MICU, who their patients have been intubated for days and days. But yeah, that's interesting to consider. So,
yeah, and I hope that, you know, collaboratively we can do a lot more studies in this space, even if we just start going around like that study I mentioned earlier, you know, and assessing neuromuscular blockade before extubation and figuring out like what we might be missing. And then taking that a step further and comparing the strategy of like, should we do an anesthesia like targeted reversal versus not, and what outcomes that gets us in our, you know, our MICU patients, for example. I think that's really where we're at in order to put up the data that's needed to change practice. Like I said, we're not there yet where I can say like, you should be doing this all the time. But based on, you know, I think the breadth of the literature that's out there. If I was the patient, I would want you to do this.
Well, especially the ones who are really tenuous. I mean, some of these people who have all kinds of reasons to fail and you've optimized them as best you can, but like you're still iffy. I mean, why not try to take that issue off the table? I mean, if it's a difference of 5 or 10% in how well they breathe, easily that could be what tips them. And if it's a matter of just giving them something like, we give a lot of drugs that are harder and more expensive to give for a lot worse reasons. Well, thanks for coming. It's been a great chat. We'll just remind everyone, these are all just our own opinions, some general educational content. We're not representing any of our various institutions here. And, you know, do your own thinking. What do we know? We will talk to you next time.